Last week, we looked in Scripture at God's concern for the poor. And as we looked at his instructions to Israel, we noticed how they were to treat the poor among them, both Jews and aliens among them, as it's termed there, or non-Jews. We noticed that a significant reason for Israel being overtaken by their enemies was that God was angry at Israel for their abuse of the poor. We notice that Ezekiel told Israel while they were in captivity, "Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy." One of the things that we noticed last week as we were walking through Scripture and looking at a variety of times when God spoke to his people about this matter was that caring for the needy is not optional. Instead, it reflects God's love through his people. It's a visible act of loving our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus identified himself as the Messiah by pointing to him fulfilling prophecies of caring for those who were poor in a variety of circumstances. Jesus initially sent his apostles primarily to the poor, and they were to go without extra money and without extra clothing in order both to be provided for by God as well as to identify with the poor. The early church, we noticed, was known for caring for the poor among themselves as well as non-Christians in their communities. Jesus' most poignant and direct teaching about this topic is in a passage that's very familiar to probably almost all of us. Matthew chapter 25, beginning at verse 31 and going through verse 46, where Jesus says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me.' Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you?' The king will reply, 'I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me.' Then he will say to those on his left, 'Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me.' They also will answer, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or needing clothes, or sick, or in prison, and did not help you?' He will reply, 'I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me.' They will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life." In verse 40, Jesus speaks of doing these things for the least of these brothers of mine. That sometimes, I think, may have been an obstacle for us, that term brothers. In the Bible, the word brother can have broad meaning. It can mean any relative or a person of the same or related nationality, or it can mean a friend. It can mean a person holding the same office, or it can mean just simply one fellow man. Or, as the Bible often terms it, one's neighbor. So Paul encouraged Christians in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, "Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially those who belong to the family of believers." One of the things that is well for us to notice in this passage in Matthew chapter 25 is that Jesus does not assign this task to some particular group of people or some particular office. He doesn't assign it to a particular group of people who have particular responsibilities. He just simply speaks of those who are his sheep, those who are blessed, those who took action, those who treated others as if they were treating Jesus himself. Those who demonstrated a level of compassion that saw past anything that might otherwise cause them to hold back. They saw people with the kind of compassionate eyes that Jesus saw people. And so whatever they did as though it were Jesus himself. Individually or as a congregation, we help people in all kinds of situations. But Jesus' words in this passage are directed at you and me as individuals, taking personal action. We can't spiritualize providing for the hungry and the thirsty by way of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 6 when he said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." In Matthew 25, in this passage we just read, Jesus means physical hunger and thirst that his people will take care of just as if it were Jesus who was in need. And the early church seemed to understand that, and they acted on it. Sometimes it may be that we look at those hungering and thirsting about us and feel overwhelmed about what we can do. Or sometimes we feel like, well, as long as the church has a pantry and there's somebody who's posted there at certain times and that's well known, that we can take care of that responsibility that way. And there's no question but that does good and that people are helped. But again, Jesus isn't speaking to someone who's given an assignment. Jesus is speaking to you and I individually, in terms of personal action. Because you know, in the early church, they didn't have a church building, and they didn't have a pantry. They had individuals who, for the most part, met to worship in homes. And so when there were hungry people, they came to people's homes. And a few of you here are probably old enough to remember a time called the Depression, when people who couldn't get work because there wasn't work would knock at people's back doors and ask for something to eat. They didn't go to church buildings, they went to homes. And individuals acted personally. Now in our time, that seems to be a distant past in every respect. For those of us who didn't live during that time, all it is to us is some kind of a mental picture that somebody's painted for us, or it's something we read in a history book, or it's something that maybe a grandparent told us about. And in our environment today, it just seems like something that we can't get our hands around. We can't see how we can be personally involved and do anything. But you and I can personally feed the hungry and the thirsty around us in our community. And I say that because there are people who are doing it. For several years, by herself, a middle-aged woman makes and brings a hearty lunch to feed 40 homeless people at Project Understanding every other Thursday. Not a crew of people, not a ministry, not a church, Not other, some other charitable organization. One middle-aged woman who is committed to helping people who are hungry and thirsty. And who does it in the name of the Lord. One individual making a difference to 40 people. When Jesus speaks of inviting in strangers and clothing those needing clothing, who's he talking about? What comes to your mind? Today in our community, very likely that would be a homeless person, wouldn't it? Someone who literally has the clothes on their back, or the clothes perhaps in the grocery cart that they're pushing all over town that makes us giggle or turn our head or say, ooh. But take them in, into my house, with my family, and clothe them? That is difficult, isn't it? It really is difficult. We don't know those people. We don't know if they're in their right mind. We don't know if they're rip-off artists. We don't know if they're going to steal us blind. We don't know. Can we, in faith, see helping them as if we were helping Christ? In 2 weeks, a fellow by the name of Peter Brown, who's Community Affairs Director for the City of Ventura, will speak to us after an abbreviated worship about positive ways that we as a congregation can help hopeless people or homeless people in Ventura. But I'd like you to listen to this, a true story from an article in a newspaper in Virginia. It's written by a woman named Lisa Suhay. This was written in December of this past year. She says, in seasons past, when I gave to charities something that's hard to afford this year, I pictured the people waiting outside my local market asking for food and the homeless sleeping hunched in buildings, building nooks, not people like me with kids, a job, and an education. My world rocked recently when I learned someone I know was about to be standing on the street. The friend didn't call for money, just my time, to help the family make phone calls to agencies and realtors. The person has children, a degree, and a long-term good job. Like many of us, this single-family income went paycheck to paycheck, just a couple of medical emergencies and an inflated car payment from the curb, and didn't know until it was too late. A lawyer advised the family to file bankruptcy, but didn't warn them that this would mean their landlord filing for immediate possession of their house. Bankruptcy and eviction mean that nobody will rent to you unless you pay nearly triple the security deposit plus the first month's rent, which nobody in that position can even dream of managing. Their families are not in a position to help, and the church can only do so much. Charities and our food banks are seeing fewer donations. I'm sick over seeing this happen to a decent, hardworking person who has always struggled to make a better life. Every agency I called dismissed the problem by offering a list of shelters. You do not put people with jobs and hope into shelters as a first option. If you want to break people who are in crisis, just tell them that Plan A, that this is Plan A. Then tell them that this is all their own fault. That's what people told me to tell my friend. I don't think now is the time for that, and frankly, it's not going to stroke their spiritual fires to tie that knot at the end of their rope and hang on. The reality is that society is not equipped to help this new, invisible, fragile pendulum class that swings back and forth between solvent and destitute so easily. If we cannot help a person with an education who's working hard to survive, we are going to become Atlantis as systems drown in debt and poverty. All we have to offer is a shelter until spring. Housing authorities uttered identical responses. Our application period is closed. I can't tell you when we'll be taking more applications. Just tell the person to keep reading the papers, and in the spring, we'll put out a notice. In Norfolk this year, The Redevelopment and Housing Authority took in more than 5,000 applications for rental and housing assistance, and of them, more than 2,000 are still in need. My friend applied and qualified for Section 8 rental and housing assistance last March and was told the agency would call if anything became available. No one ever called. And now the family must reapply and wait, possibly in a shelter, just to get back on the list to not be called. This is not about one person, but a community and how we look upon those we seek to help through charitable giving and year-round programmed assistance. It is also about attitude. I wasn't even the person in crisis, and by the end of the week, I was so depressed, demoralized, and gun-shy about picking up the phone to call the cleverly overworked people who man the agency telephones. The conclusion I've come to is that it is up to us to do what we can for individuals who cross our paths. There are many ways to give. And as I said, 2 weeks from tonight, Peter Brown will be here to talk with us about some of those very ways that we can give. You know, you and I can personally and congregationally provide shelter for the homeless if we'll just be a little bit creative. For more than 20 years, a variety of churches in the Nashville area have opened their buildings for winter sleeping and dinner to homeless people. And a church in Ojai is doing that now and has been doing it for several years. And thinking of poor people with apartments but no beds, a Texas church formed an alliance with Head Start to provide mattresses and bedding to needy children. And in 5 years, they have provided more than 500 beds. Individual action, congregational action. And maybe you read this just back in November of 2007 in the Christian Chronicle. An article written by a woman named Jenny Curran. She says, "When we see homeless people, we often want to turn away and not see the pain that they endure. We sometimes think that they want to live that way, but reason dictates that no one in their right mind wants to live out in the cold and rain. After a tragic loss in our family, my husband and I moved from the serenity of the forest surrounded by huge trees and a large porch with a water view in North Vancouver, British Columbia, to the heart of the inner city of Vancouver. It was what we needed. We soon noticed a large number of men pushing grocery carts filled with cans and bottles. We could see from their appearance that they were having trouble, and we wanted to understand their story. So one day, we stopped a man and talked to him about his life experience. This is when we first began to learn about homeless people. Many are mentally ill. Many are addicts. Many have had physical problems such as brain injuries." She goes on to say, "We wanted to do something to use our grief and God's grace to help the homeless. And in 2005, we established a collaborative relationship with a local shelter and started interviewing the people who came through its doors. We asked them a simple question: what would you like for Christmas? And out of that was born the Homeless Partners Christmas Wish List. It spread from where they were living in Vancouver onto Alberta. Churches got involved with it deeply. Began to see an opportunity to actually personally do something to help people directly." She goes on to say that some of the homeless who had been on the streets for decades changed their hardened, weathered expression into ones of beaming children on Christmas morning when they read their name on gifts and received cards created oftentimes by children just for them. One woman said, "The most encouraging thing is knowing that people care. I find it really encouraging that total strangers could care so much about someone they don't even know." But it was the Christians who received the most encouragement by realizing that they had led the way for others to put the love and grace of Jesus into practice, even those who don't know him. I, along with many others, actually felt grace, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And for us, it was a healing step. The poor were helped. The community saw the church in a positive light, and God got the glory. It was all a result of God's grace because He gave us the supreme gift, His Son. Individually, you and I can give of our time and our abilities to something that we've all heard of a great deal, and something that's as local as Oxnard, and yet something that's global in nature. Habitat for Humanity. They're always looking for personal involvement as well as congregational involvement. They do things in the name of the Lord, to God's glory. In terms of looking after the ill, Jesus speaks of looking after the sick and visiting those in prison. Modern-day healthcare relieves us from having to look after the sick, doesn't it? It's not that they're dependent upon us anymore. Or they might like to see us. We might cheer their day. We might mean a great deal to them emotionally and spiritually, raising their spirits tremendously. But they don't look to us for their healthcare. And some of us do visit our ill members. Thank God for that, and thank you for that if you're one such person. And a few teach imprisoned people about Jesus through our letters. But who of us visit those who are imprisoned? It's hard to see them as if they were Christ, isn't it? In terms of looking after the ill and visiting the imprisoned, we should never think individually that we have nothing to offer. Nor should we think that it's a daunting task. The thing that we need to do is to see ourselves as serving Christ. We need to perhaps force ourselves and repeat to ourselves over and over that any service that we give to the ill and to the imprisoned, perhaps in particular, is as doing it for Christ. And so we can go see the ill, even if we feel like we don't have anything particularly uplifting to say or helpful to say, even if we feel tongue-tied and feel like we just don't know what to say or do. We don't know if it's going to help them. But the imprisoned, that's frightening, isn't it? It's outright frightening. If you've ever been in a jail or a prison, it's not the most comfortable place to be, even though you're not an inmate. James Comer remarked, "No significant learning occurs without significant relationship." And it's true in a prison or jail setting as much as anywhere else. We have more to offer than we see in ourselves. Many of you are familiar with the writings of Leo Biscaglia. He wrote in his book Born for Love, "The majority of us lead quiet, unheralded lives as we pass through this world. There will most likely be no ticker tape parades for us, no monuments created in our honor. But that does not lessen our possible impact, for there are scores of people waiting for someone just like us to come along. People who will appreciate our compassion, our encouragement, people who will need our unique talents, someone who will live a happier life merely because we took the time to share what we have to give. Too often we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest compliment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which have the potential to turn a life around. It's overwhelming to consider the continuous opportunities there are to make our love felt." Caring treatment of others is not how we get into God's kingdom, but it is evidence of being God's child, as you and I who are Christians extend God's love and mercy from His life into the life of others. And as we recognize that every person is created by God in His image, whatever they look like, however scary or dirty or smelly or hopeless they may seem to be. They are people we need to look at as though they were Jesus. A lack of personal or congregational involvement in these things comes from not thinking of them and serving them as though they were Jesus. We must think of our personal involvement in them, in their lives, in their needs, if we hope to be welcomed into God's kingdom at Christ's return. That seems to be the upshot of this passage in Matthew, doesn't it? We'll need to reevaluate our personal and family and congregational values and priorities and activities if we're going to do that. Because we're already all too busy, aren't we? And unless something changes within our lives, nothing is going to happen in their lives from us. The three scriptures that are helpful to stimulate our thinking about these things. In Psalm 140 and verse 12, it tells us that the Lord secures justice for the poor and upholds the cause of the needy. The Lord does that because the poor and the needy are important to Him. He cares about them. He's concerned about their well-being. And if God does that, doesn't it follow that His children must also? Romans 12, verse 8 says that if a Christian's spiritual gift is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. There are a great many things that we give to in this life. Probably all of us in some way give to the Lord's work here, as well as to a variety of other charities that have personal meaning to us of some kind. But what about direct giving of some kind to those we know are in need? 1 John 3, verse 17 tells us, if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? It's a sobering question, isn't it? Particularly when all of us, to some extent, have material possessions. And unless we absolutely blind ourselves in some fashion, we see people around us all the time who are in need. The question is, do we have pity that extends to action? In Matthew 25, Jesus calls for us to serve others as if serving Him. But it's not just a means of eliciting compassion that Jesus frames it this way. Because taking care of physical and spiritual needs of others is the way of life that Jesus lived. And if we are to imitate Him, so must we live that way. There's only really one question that comes out of that, isn't there? Are you and I living to serve others, whoever and who all they might be, as we have opportunity, as if they were Jesus? If we can be of any aid to anyone here tonight, we would ask you to come forward right now as we stand and sing this song.